This is Mae Brussel. This is the second half of World Watchers program number 757. And I'm describing certain articles that are in the news now being written by other people on their fears of Ronald Reagan using agent provocateurs to get us closer to World War III and the methods that he's using that have been used in the past that we have to be more aware of, as this Congress just gives him everything he wants without any argument. And it is leading us to a crisis situation right across the board. I was just citing an article from In These Times, the attention that Robert Scheer, the writer for the Los Angeles Times, called to how many years it took to acknowledge that the Gulf of Tonkin was excuse for Lyndon Johnson to get us into the Vietnam War, and how long it took to get the admission that it was fake, that it didn't, the Gulf of Tonkin didn't happen the way it was told to us by the news media and the Pentagon at the time. And this article goes on to say, in less than a month, the Reagan administration's claim of irrefutable evidence of Libyan complicity in the bombing of the West Berlin La Belle Disco, which prompted the U.S. bombing raid on Libya, is looking more and more like another fake job by U.S. intelligence. And we should be alert for these fake jobs, since undoubtedly the Reagan administration is readying one in connection with Nicaragua. On April 28th, 2 weeks after the disco bombing, a reporter from Stars and Stripes was interviewed. He interviewed Manfred Ganschau, chief of the Berlin Stasutz, that's the FBI, the equivalent of the FBI in Germany. Unlike the West German Intelligence Service, and there is a difference, which was sensitive to political priorities of the Reagan administration as well as Chancellor Kohl, Ganschau, who heads a 100-person unit actually investigating the disco bombing, was dealing with the practical realities. According to his record of the interview sent by the man from Stars and Stripes, the United States military paper, Ganschau said on April 28th that following the arrest of Ahmed Mansour Hassi, he had no more evidence that Libya was connected to the bombing than I had when you first called me 2 days after the act, which is none. He added that he was making this statement although he was fully aware of all the talk being intercepted about intercepted messages from Libya, and that this case is far from being solved. We're still tracking down other leads, and they are totally non-political. The man from Stars and Stripes said, "We have the American ambassador and the German government saying they have positive proof there was a Libyan connection. On the other side, you have the police saying there is no proof." And last week on World Watchers, I cited the anger of the American, not the American ambassador, but deputy ambassador in the Soviet Union, being totally furious that the Soviet Union hinted that the CIA was involved in that bombing, and he said he would monitor the Soviet television and newspapers, and the response of the Soviet Union was, how do you cancel out or censor what we say? It isn't like America. Now, the Washington Times, June the 2nd, had an article on the Berlin bombing, and again, it goes back to the excuses Ronald Reagan can use for doing something he planned for 4 or 5 years. It's titled Terrorist Base. It goes on, reliable West European intelligence sources report in the investigation of East Berlin bombing, the role there, that there was a terrorist base set up that was involved in the bombing of La Belle Discotheque in West Berlin. They've uncovered a major new terrorist operation established. Now, this is what they include. Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Members of the terrorist group also include Palestinian dissidents from the Palestine Liberation Organization, including leader Yasser Arafat, and Gaddafi and Arafat are bitter enemies, and it includes the Al-Fatah, and also they're linked to Abu Nidal Group, and several Americans who are associated with renegade ex-CIA operative Edwin Wilson, who went on Gaddafi's payroll during the mid-1970s. So this is another account of throwing in Gaddafi when the leads are going to Abu Nidal, the CIA, and it also has been mentioned in this story, George Habash from Jordan, who's directly linked with the Central Intelligence Agency and with the PLO terrorist groups. And the article says that suspect Ahmed Hassi, 35, a Palestinian resident of West Berlin, focused authorities' attention on the office of an African who was publishing information service for English interpreters. Every volume the service produces contains numerous Gaddafi quotations, but the authorities searched his apartment and found coded shipping list and a telephone number, not only of the Libyan People's Bureau in East Berlin, but a Damascus telephone number believed to be Abu Nidal's headquarters. So they have these two phone listings, and I mentioned last week one of the primary witnesses to this case, who was killed on a bench outside the Libyan embassy in Berlin and could have been the agent provocateur for the bombing at the in Berlin and the telephone conversations down to Libya that were the excuse for Ronald Reagan to test new weapons. That's another thing he did by having a shootout or shooting one way with Muammar Gaddafi, was to get contracts for future weapons and see how they go. And also, another reason cited in some articles was to test our allies to see if they would go along with us, and only Great Britain would, but to see who was friend and foe and remember it for future behavior. And there were a lot of things accomplished by this action. As I say, it was planned a long time ago. Freedom Magazine, and I've cited it several times, it's put out by the Scientologists, and in their last current issue, volume 18, number 10, a continuing series of articles is printed by Fletcher Prouty. This is part 11 on the CIA in Vietnam. And the gist of this article is about how John Kennedy came into office and how the CIA actually made policy and the conflict between the elected president and his officials versus an agency that is already entrenched, and how much do you make decisions. And then Fletcher Prouty goes on to say that Kennedy was killed because he opposed the decisions made up by the CIA, which were made originally put together by James Angleton and Richard Helms and William Casey, who worked with Raymond Donovan of the OSS, the man who is being honored this past week with Ronald Reagan as the guest of honor at that particular dinner. So the heritage of the OSS to the CIA goes on through John Kennedy and, as I say, James Angleton and the various people at that banquet that were involved in the murder of Kennedy, as part of their policy, were getting together and still patting themselves on the back for the covert work they've done all around the world and continue to do. Now, I want to do the remaining time on this broadcast going back to Chernobyl. I was talking last week on why I believe it was sabotage, and I want to go into the very fundamental parts of the news media, because it is the news media through which we get our information. And the mass media, the television, is made mostly controlled by a few people, a handful of people. General Electric just finalized their sale of NBC, and that's a large military grab of a major network. And William Casey of the OSS CIA has his control over ABC, and Michael Deaver is a lobbyist for CBS, and also Henry Kissinger is one of the important advisors for CBS. And the military and the Pentagon have a big handle on what comes over the television. And the printed newspapers have good articles, a lot of good articles, but they also spread, along with television, the policies that the administration and the Pentagon want. And then later, when there's retractions or differences, and they sometimes get published too, they're put on page 26 or 30 or page 45 or section, page 7 of section D, and you have to go from cover to cover of the newspaper to pick up any alternate point of view or read some other of the small publications that are around. Now, just before the nuclear accident in the Soviet Union, and I was citing last week some of the articles that preceded it, 5 weeks before the accident, the Washington Post had a long article, Soviet Nuclear Industry Pushes to Double Capacity in 5 Years. And it tells how they were lagging behind, and it's like a student studying for exams, but they were catching up. And within the next few years, they would double their capacity. So the Soviet Union's nuclear capacity was definitely a threat to the United States. Now, the New York Times published an article in the San Francisco Chronicle the same date, Chernobyl Memos. The title is United States Criticized for Withholding News. And this is very important to how we get our information, because Ronald Reagan, for the first time in over 100 years of battle, ordered no reporters at the Grenada invasion, and they were invited to see some of it 4 days later, 3 and 4 days later, but couldn't be there. And he took away all reporters to the Gulf of Sidra and the Libyan bombings. And this is the third most notable event where no reporters were allowed to give interviews or experts were allowed to talk to the media. The article says the Reagan administration, which criticized the Soviet Union for withholding details of the nuclear reactor accident, is being criticized itself for ordering curbs on comments to the press after the Chernobyl disaster. The Reagan administration ordered curbs to the comments. Representative Edward Markey of Massachusetts made public two internal department memos of energy from the Energy Department, which the contractors and the employers worked out or were told what to do from the Reagan administration. They were told, in quotes, to avoid commenting or speculating on the accident, and they were to forward all calls to the public affairs of the interagency group. A similar memo was sent out by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It was read by the New York Times the week of May 23rd, and the Agriculture Department memo to the same effect was mailed anonymously to the Times by various people involved, showing the censorship around those people who had information about the nuclear plants. They were forbidden to speak. The agency officials said the memos were intended. Their overt purpose was to limit the alarm and limit conflicting information, and yet the Pentagon and the Reagan administration and RAND Corporation saturated the media with disinformation while the authorities who knew were told that they couldn't talk about the accident, the cause or effects, and so forth. The article goes on, various staff and contractor employees in Washington and at the national laboratories such as Brookhaven and Sandia were barred from giving out facts of previous nuclear accidents or of nuclear matters unrelated to the accident in Soviet Union that they could fill in on the type of reactors. They were forbidden to give any interviews. And this reminds me of celebrations or remembrances of the anniversary of John Kennedy, where the people who've done the long, hardest work, like myself, are not allowed to give a comment. But those who have been known to cover up many of the facts are allowed to be on the media. The article said the reporters had trouble reaching busy public affairs specialists to whom the technical staff members referred them. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Department of Energy referred them to people who were not available. They said that the daily press briefings in Washington were insufficient. The excuse for the blackout from the Energy Department, dated April 29th, was given by David Goldman, manager of the agency's Argonne area. It said, you must curtail possible misinformation, and you are advised to avoid commenting on the situation in Russia, avoid making comparisons between American reactors and Russian ones. Now, the first news media for 6 days said that the Soviet Union had a reactor that was built differently than the ones we had, and that we don't have those. And after the ban on the comment was over and experts began to speak up and wouldn't take this hushing, they said that we have plants identical to theirs. But for the first few days, we were told, if you read the newspapers or heard the television, that the Russians didn't care for life, didn't take precautions, had the nuclear plants that were dangerous that we don't have. The article goes on, another memo dated May the 2nd from Delbert Bunch, acting deputy assistant secretary for reactor deployment, said it goes without saying that no one should volunteer separate or independent speculation to the press. This was a memo that was passed on the New York Times, one April 29th and one May the 2nd. A third memo, April 30th, was sent to 3,400 Regulatory Commission employees from Victor Stella, the agency's top staff official. He said, in quotes, there is a strong determination on the part of the United States government to speak with one voice on all matters related to Chernobyl. Imagine the fact that one voice, we're ordering you, can only speak. And then it goes on, until roles and responsibilities are established, all requests for information from sources external to the agency, like the Nuclear Regulatory, should be funneled to three people, and those three people were identified on the memo. This same April 30th, a memo said the Agricultural Department, too, from Mr. M.E. Carter, Associate Administrator of Agriculture Research, told all employees with knowledge about nuclear effects on food or agriculture to offer no conjectures. Now, many of these people went to college and then went on to graduate school and have had a lot of graduate work as scientists in this field. That was called conjectures, even though there were 6, 8, 10 years of hard work and scientific training to give an opinion, and they were the ones who might have a valid opinion. Most of us don't know what's going on. Representative Markey is going to have hearings on this issue. He said the Soviet secrecy may be inexcusable, but it is hypocritical to condone the gagging of United States experts paid with taxpayers' dollars. Markey said it is troubling that the agency officials were urged to avoid making comparisons between the Soviet Union and the United States, since there are comparisons to be made. Our energy departments and various reactors have similar fuel cores, and the American press was stymied while the propaganda media shouted away. Now, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, I talked about them last week, were the two so-called experts that shouted the loudest. And this breaking of the Chernobyl plant, called breaking of the explosion there, happened just 3 weeks before, 4 weeks before the money was to run out on Radio Free America. And there were two articles indicating how important they are to the world based upon the Chernobyl accident. And I can't believe all of this is coincidental. Now, the first one is published in the Washington Post by Malcolm S. Forbes, one of the richest men of America, who's been now assigned to the head of Radio Free Liberty and Radio Europe and Radio Free Europe. He comes from his own publication. He's well known, his financial publication, and he travels around the world with tremendous prestige. And he replaced William Shakespeare and James Buckley, both Knights of Malta, as the head of the United States Radio Free, they call it Radio Liberty and Radio Free America. And May 19th, this is what he wrote. A threat to both U.S. radios in Europe. He said, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty are in jeopardy. The Chernobyl nuclear disaster emphasized the importance of the stations to the people of Eastern Europe and Russia. The stations are a source of news of breaking for the audiences in the Soviet bloc. We have provided them with practical advice for survival, and they fed them the material about how many were dead and that they didn't know it and their lives were in danger. He said more than 50 million adults behind the Iron Curtain listen at least once a week, yet Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty may have to stop broadcasting. The immediate problem is our station is in Munich. The money is paid in West German marks. Congress had allocated us 100 million to run this broadcast once a week. That's 52 broadcasts inside the Soviet Union. I've done World Watchers free an hour a week for 15 years. And it cost them $100 million. And because of the difference of the German mark and the American dollar has plunged, they need an extra $22 million right away. That's $122 million. And he goes on to say that he knows that American people will grant this money through a special emergency fund. He says, though the costs are small potatoes by Washington standards, the radio plays a vital role for the United States and the West. Change in the totalitarian society of the Soviet bloc won't come about on the battlefield in the nuclear age. It will come about through internal pressures such as those brought by Solidarity in Poland. And there would be no Solidarity without Radio Free Europe. It would cease to exist. And again, the big factors of world change. One is chemicals, what is put in your food and water to change your body. And the other is the mind, through mind control, drugs, and also through the media. And he says, the battle is the battle for the mind. Give us the extra $122 million, and we'll give you a broadcast for 52 weeks going into Eastern Europe. Now, Cord Meyer, a veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency, going way, way back, and I believe he was in the OSS too, part of that early gang, writes for Reverend Moon's paper under Arnaud de Borchgrave, and I think I cited that parts of this article last week, a long article, How Our Radios Informed the Soviet Bloc. And he goes on to say that when the winds in Sweden forced the Soviets to admit there was a nuclear disaster, it was Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty that let the people know, and Voice of America, the first news, and it forced the Russians to reveal and disgorge information vital to the health of their population. And he continues, Mr. Kordmeyer of the CIA, we stick with the facts. We avoid exaggeration of some American media coverage. And, of course, that turned out not to be true at all. There was plenty of exaggeration across the board. He says tourists in Russia will reveal later when they come home from there and we take polls that there's deep concern of any media except our radio, distrust of the Soviet media, And it's important that we take a poll. Goodness knows who they are. Maybe 100 CIA agents who come home and say it's the most important news they ever had. And Meyer says the people living in the Soviet Union, particularly Ukraine, have learned they can't depend on their own government to alert them in health hazards. They have to rely on foreign radios. And that's why I think an agent provocateur responsible for informing the people in the plant could walk away and not tell them because these scripts were so well read and delivered immediately after the accident. He goes on to say, we added 2 extra hours to broadcasting in the Ukrainian language, giving the medical advice from the radio. The sequence of events that took place drew a large listening audience in the Iron Curtain. If you want to find out quickly what is going on that affects your lives, you rely on us, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, and not the Soviet Union. Tune in regularly to our program and protect yourself against unpleasant surprises. And he goes on to say, this incident, the Chernobyl, isn't a single discrete event like the Soviet shooting down of the Korean Airlines. And he throws that in. He says, this is a long tail to the disasters of the delayed and cumulative human consequences of radioactive poisoning. And it's very important that these people have our radio program to hear it, because we need equipment. We need to build up our funds. We don't have money. And as I cited last week, if you don't give it to us from Congress, we will have to take it from the Defense Department, as if the Defense Department wasn't running Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe and Voice of America right from the beginning. We'll take it from the defense. They'll have that $122 million, maybe $200 or $300 million, because they're not going to stop. And this article by Cord Meyer of the CIA says, on the front line of the war are ideas. And that's what Mr. Malcolm Forbes is saying, that people have to listen to these programs because they are priority, a high priority in the light of their handling the Chernobyl incidents, and that the war of ideas must continue through the covert operations of Radio Free America and Radio Liberty and so forth. Now, right after the nuclear accident, and the world became aware of it, in April, the accident took place on the 26th. April 29th, there was an article in the newspaper, a Washington Post, Kremlin may be phasing out old-style nuke plants. And the suggestion is maybe they didn't use crucial safeguards because they were going to phase these out, that these weren't the practical kinds of nuclear plants, and the radio leak came from irresponsibility. And the Soviet Union already has 50 atomic plants, and the graphite is outdated. So maybe they were getting careless with this plant, and it'd be easier to let it go or blow, and they didn't care. Now, that's what I think happened with the people at Muscle Shoals, Alabama, at Marshall Space Center, the level that has been charged with the responsibility of literally forcing the shuttle. This shuttle was damaged, and by stopping the NASA program as it exists or tearing apart the shuttle program, if they can do it, then it becomes all military in the very people that want World War III, the heritage of Wernher von Braun and Walter Dornberger and the Pundemunt scientists. If you control space, you control the world, and forget all the hanky-panky. So the suggestion immediately after the Chernobyl affair that the Russians had a lemon and they were willing to let it go sounds sort of like the script of the Challenger, where they knew it was going to go and could stack it with their rainbow coalition and have them all go at the same time. Now, the United Press retracted their fatality count. You don't very often see a major news service like Associated Press, United Press apologizing, but May the 24th, United Press, 1 month after the Chernobyl accident and the scare, they retracted the count. The editor-in-chief, Maxwell McCrohan, said that after a thorough investigation, UPI could no longer stand by its nuclear accident story. Now, the UPI got the story from an anonymous person who called in and gave it to them, a Soviet woman with professional hospital contacts who was known to the UPI reporter. And after she gave it to the UPI, then ABC, NBC, and CBS followed immediately with the stories. And he said, after news of the accident, the Kiev sources made contact with UPI. A Soviet woman with professional hospital contacts was one of those people who knew the UPI reporter. She supplied information and talked about the buses and evacuation and the residents around the plant. And she informed them that 80 people had been killed at the reactor site. 2,000 died immediately afterwards. After that, the woman disappeared And this was carried in the American press, and it was an unconfirmed report, and they apologized for the report. Now, ABC and NBC each put up $11,000 to a person in Italy who showed them the nuclear plant burning away. This was reported in the LA Times, May 15th. Networks were duped. Chernobyl was Trieste. And this tells about red-faced NBC News and ABC News saying they made a mistake Monday in showing videotape scenes of a nuclear reactor that was burning and in flames when it was on the evening news, when actually it was a factory at Trieste, Italy, and nobody bothered to check it. The tape was acquired by the Rome bureaus from another unidentified Yugoslav man who said he was near Chernobyl the day after the disaster when it was burning down. Now, Dan Rather, who reported the explanation and the apologies of NBC and ABC, said that millions of European viewers also saw the video on their newscast, and that a 24-year-old Frenchman, who he didn't identify, had been arrested in Italy and charged with fraud and faking. Now, denial may come at a point where someday people watching the first account won't remember that it was fake, that this place that was smoking was in Trieste, and it was not at Chernobyl at all. But their apologizing for being hoodwinked is hardly possible when I think of people like Dan Rather seeing photographs, Dealey Plaza, the Abraham Zapruder picture of John Kennedy's head actually being going backwards, and the law of physics shows how that you have to be shot from the front to have the reaction of the head being thrown back. And Dan Rather would say the head went forward, and the television has been a major source of disinformation, of Cold War, of escalating a lot of hot wars. And they took this from a person that wasn't reliable, just as they took the story of the woman in the Soviet Union with the figures and put it into the UPI, and then it was picked up by everybody else. That while all this disinformation was going on, and this is the main point of all this, the people with information that is knowledgeable were forbidden to talk to the press on orders of the American government of the Reagan administration. While the disinformation was coming out, they were not allowed to talk. Now, there were a lot of articles, not a lot, but a few, later, after the situation died down, such as this. Here's one from the Daily World: coverage of an accident, nuclear accident, based on a few facts. Another one from the Soviet Union: and Soviet attacks Western propaganda. This was in the Washington Post, and Mr. Gorbachev and the Soviet Union was accusing the United States of whipping up hysteria by printing disinformation. Another article, May 5th, in the Los Angeles Herald: George Shultz denies U.S. sensationalizing events at Chernobyl. And he was told that it was a kick in the face for Mr. Gorbachev. He wasn't, the Soviet Union was told that by way of the news media and on their radios, and Shultz had very hard words to say about the Soviet Union, and he was accused of carrying on this media propaganda at the time of the accident. There was another article, tourists protest media hysteria on an accident, and it tells about their being in the Soviet Union and the contrast behind the news that they heard and what they thought was really happening. In another article, I have anti-Soviet aim of the United States is it, one of the reasons they can get away with this is through controlled media. And this is about the controlled media and what the media hid from Chernobyl. And there were about 8 or 10 very good articles, one titled Propaganda from Tragedy. And I may go over some of these with you. They're very important. And in these times ran a story, Facts Emerging from Chernobyl, and The Guardian had an article, Who Are You Going to Trust? The U.S. Exploits the Chernobyl Accident to Justify Soviet Peace Proposals. The end result of all this sabotage and so forth was that overtly Reagan could say within days of the explosion, now the arms treaty is off, no more assault. You can't trust them, so why sit down? They won't tell their own people about a nuclear reaction, so we can't sit and talk about the arms control. Another interesting article in the Monterey Herald, I don't think it was on the wire service, written by Michael Woods, U.S. conclusions on Chernobyl question. And he's asking from Moscow, were we right in saying the things we did? And he talks about the reactor and the way it was built in the Soviet Union and referred to Wigner Energy. He said the Windscale fire began when technicians were doing a routine maintenance procedure. When graphite is subjected to intense radiation, it is stored energy, it swells, and loses its thermal properties. The stored energy is called Wigner, W-I-G-N-E-R, energy, after Dr. Eugene Wigner, the famous atomic physicist, who first described the phenomena. Now, Eugene Wigner is a member of the institution called Western Goals, with Edward Teller, Roy Cohn, John Singlaub, that very important person, and the late Larry McDonald. Also, Eugene Wigner was lauded and was one of the main speakers at the convention that Reverend Moon had just recently in Texas of scientists and so forth. Wigner is a part of the nuclear industry. He worked with Einstein on the first atomic bombs, the type of reactor that was used in the Soviet Union, and the reaction to what happened there uses his name. And I've just run through quickly, because there isn't much time, some of these characters that walk through the pages of history in other forms connecting with organizations such as Western Goals. But my time is up now. I would like to do more on the nuclear reactor in the weeks to come, but in the meantime, this is it for this hour. This is Mae Brussel, and I'll be back with you next week. Thanks again for all the articles and books, and I'll try to answer your mail as soon as I can.